This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
One of the top legislative priorities of the new Conservative government is childcare, eliminating existing federal funding to the provinces for early learning and childcare programs. This money will be replaced with the federal choice in childcare allowance, $1,200 per year paid to parents for each child under the age of six. Heather Northrup is a Vancouver parent and childcare advocate. She has been a member of the BC Childcare Council, an advisory group to the province, since the 1990s. She recently resigned as vice chair of the council as a result of the provincial government's reaction to Stephen Harper's plans for childcare. The BC Liberals have not spoken in favor of maintaining the existing federal-provincial agreements. Heather Northrup joins me now in the studio. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning.
In September 2005, the federal and BC governments signed this agreement, which committed approximately $650 million to the province for early learning and childcare. Can you tell us a bit about this agreement?
Well, the agreement itself was the product of an awful lot of work by academics and childcare advocates throughout Canada for probably over 20 years or so. More recently, there has been some significant research out of Toronto and out of Vancouver and around the world indicating how good quality early learning and childcare is very important to our youngest members of society. Consequently, that has attracted the attention of policymakers in Canada. In my opinion, it's way overdue, but finally it's gotten the attention that it deserves. And so happily, an agreement was signed acknowledging that clearly what the private sector couldn't do on its own over 20 years by providing quality early learning and care for all of Canada's children. This was a significant step, a start. It wasn't completely, it wouldn't be funds enough to make sure that every child had a free early learning opportunity, but it was a significant start to build a foundation for that. And so to the extent that there was obviously support from the NDP and the Bloc and the Liberals, there was great support for that and an acknowledgement of that.
And so were you happy with this agreement?
I was very happy with the agreement because I thought it was a significant step in the right direction and that it would allow communities to be able to address some of the chronic issues in childcare, for example, the high cost of childcare, and from a parent's perspective in particular as well, the very long waiting lists that are seen for quality centers across the country.
Can you talk a bit more about some of the existing problems for childcare options?
Well, probably from a parent perspective, there are really two. One, finding quality childcare when you need it, and two, being able to afford to provide your child with a quality early learning and childcare experience. Now, this is true whether or not you are a parent who requires full-time care for your child while you are working, or even just a quality preschool experience because you want more of a part-time approach. There are even waiting lists for those spaces as well. And particularly now I'm talking about Vancouver. In some areas of the city, there are no infant toddler childcare spaces anywhere from a nonprofit perspective. There's sort of an ad hoc number of family childcare providers, some of whom provide excellent quality care and are licensed and regulated, but those spaces are extremely rare. So outside of large urban centers, it's extremely difficult to find quality care for your child if you need to go back to work.
And is there no existing provincial quality standard?
Well, certainly the province has regulations governing child care facilities. The legislative regime in in British Columbia has guidelines. There are also, however, exceptions to those guidelines, and there are some centers, some local family homes that can be called licensed not required, that they still have to meet some minimum general standards, but from a parent perspective, really, anyone can open up their doors and offer to babysit, and that can be a perfectly legitimate private arrangement that can work out very well, and this can be an option for parents, but there's also the other side of the coin where those arrangements are not satisfactory by any stretch of the imagination, and we've certainly, in my experience as a parent, have heard some not so good stories from parents trying to find quality care.
What would you like to see in a public child care program?
Well, I'd really like to be able to see primarily probably three things. First of all, affordable for any parent who wants their child to have that opportunity or needs to have their child to have that opportunity if they have to work. So the waiting lists have to be addressed. The cost has to be addressed, for sure. In addition, I think the other thing that is fundamental from a parent perspective is we need to make sure that any kind of system that we build is one that ensures that quality of care is absolutely paramount, because parents faced with the choice of not finding quality care are going to stay at home. They're not going to put their child in a situation that they don't feel comfortable and that they don't feel as enriching for their child. So to that end, I think some serious money needs to be put on the table to make sure that child care workers are paid what they deserve, given the significant responsibilities that they have and the training that they have the work that they do in helping parents appreciate the early learning years and appreciate early childhood development and help, gosh me, struggle with the day-to-day tantrums sometimes that my daughter would have. They've been enormously helpful in helping me as a parent develop coping mechanisms to be a better parent, quite frankly. And it's fabulous to have access to that kind of expertise, because at the end of the day, it makes me a better parent.
The federal money for the first year of the five-year agreement has already been sent to the provinces. What's this money being used for in British Columbia?
Well, there was an announcement in September by Minister Hagan, and primarily the focus of that announcement was twofold. I think one was an increase in capital funding to allow centers that qualify to be able to expand their spaces so that they could address waiting list issues. The other significant component of the funding was an increase in the ability of families to be able to qualify for financial aid in being able to provide their children with affordable child care. So previously, a family earning $21,000 a year would qualify for a full subsidy of child care. So basically, you'd have to pay minimal amount or no amount for child care. That has been moved up to $38,000 a year. So I believe, if I'm remembering it correctly, I think that they had thought that this would allow at least 6,000 more children, or maybe even 26,000 more children, to be able to actually access child care, because of the issues of affordability would be removed by this increase in subsidy. So those are significant.
The new federal government has said it will only honor the first 2 years of the federal provincial agreement. So we've gotten the first year's money, and they'll give us the second year. Mm-hmm. Can our provincial government put pressure on the Conservatives to honor the full agreement?
Well, at the end of the day, I mean, certainly they have a commitment that they signed with the Government of Canada in September. There is a clause in the agreement that allows either party to walk away from it on 1 year's notice. But at the end of the day, they've committed for 5 years. So to me, it seems to me, if you have an agreement and you have a commitment, absent some significant reason, and I don't see one, I don't understand why BC would walk away from a commitment that it had. I also don't understand why Prime Minister Harper thinks that it's appropriate to walk away from these commitments, given the fact that he's a minority government, and given the fact that on a popular vote and House vote basis, it appears to me that most Canadians actually support the Liberal plan, or something even grander than that, for early learning and childcare in this country.
And Campbell has been fairly silent on this issue, hasn't he?
Campbell has not stood out and made comments, as has the Premier of Ontario, and made a commitment that he expects Canada to honour the agreement over the full 5 years. I was, quite frankly, very disappointed at that approach, and I don't know what his plans are. Maybe I'm wrong, and maybe he will be able to secure the $633 million. But quite frankly, given all of the other premiers' comments, and given some Conservative senators' comments that there are provincial premiers who are willing to walk away, and Premier Campbell not stepping in and clarifying whether he's one of these premiers or not, I think it's profoundly disappointing.
And this is the reason that you resigned from the Advisory Council?
Yes, I certainly was very concerned when I didn't hear a voice. And at the end of the day, I can't be on an Advisory Council that would that is faced with advising government that's prepared to walk away from $600 million. If that's the direction that he chooses to go, that's fine, but I just can't be involved in that, because I think that there are going to be families and children who are going to be profoundly affected in a negative way by not accessing this funding.
You mentioned the minority government position, and we had this week the Liberal government announce, the Liberal opposition announce that they won't support the Conservatives on their childcare plan, and the NDP has been fairly vocal about wanting a national childcare program, and the Bloc seems to support more of the system that they have in Quebec, which is much more public. Given that the government is fairly constrained and it is in a minority position and fairly weak, what sort of political pressure can we apply now to stop this move?
Well, I think probably the biggest thing that parents can do is to let their provincial politicians and to let their federal politicians know how important childcare is. I think they also need to let them know that $1,200 that Stephen Harper is planning on giving is not going to create spaces, it's not going to reduce fees. And it's important that constituents let their politicians know at all levels of government that this is a community need that is one that needs to be addressed now for a whole variety of reasons, most of all for the benefit of our children.
Well, thank you for speaking with me this morning, Heather.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Heather Northrup, the former vice chair of the BC Child Care Council. This is Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
The fight against slot machines in an East Vancouver park is going to court. In the summer of 2004, the City of Vancouver decided to allow the installation of slots in Hastings parks once a number of conditions had been met. Last fall, shortly before the municipal election, they rezoned prime land in the park to allow a casino to operate there. The Hastings Park Conservancy is a grassroots neighborhood organization that opposes the plan to allow slots in the park, and they have taken their fight with the city to the BC Supreme Court, where their case will be heard next month. And I'm joined now by David Bornman, who's a director of the Hastings Park Conservancy. Hi, David, welcome.
Hi, Lorraine. Thanks for having us here.
What stage is the casino development process at right now?
Right now, they're still going through their permits and their planning, and their engineers are taking measurements and that sort of thing. So no ground has been broken yet as far as actually their reconstruction of the buildings there.
But the zoning itself has been approved for that area to allow a casino in there.
The zoning was finalized in October, and that was ahead of schedule, which is what the issue in court is right now, is that they rezoned before having completed the requirements that they had set for themselves.
And how much of the park has been rezoned?
The entire park. Actually, the zoning covers the Agridome, the Pacific Coliseum, and even the Hastings Park Community Center. All of it is covered by the zoning and can be slot machines at a future date could be put in.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a large area. If the process is to go ahead, what would that look like in the park? What kind of development would we be looking at there?
The park itself would not look a whole lot different than it does right now. Right now, 20% of the park is given to the racetrack, and they have, like, we have 160 acres. A fifth of our park is in their control. They run the horse races all the time. And all of the slot machine development is within their zone already. So it won't actually look that much different for the park. It's just simply that the neighborhood did not want it. In fact, the entire city said that they were two-thirds of the city was against the idea of having slots in a park. And council decided to go ahead anyway against a big public outcry, but they put in a lot of requirements because of how the public was feeling, and now they've decided to bypass those requirements and rezone before they finished.
So as you say, that your court case against the city of Vancouver, which is going to happen next month, is based on your assertion that the city didn't meet its own conditions before they rezoned the land and the park. So what are the key things that they've promised that they haven't fulfilled?
Well, a major thing that affects us as the Hastings Park Conservancy, we were formed to help the Parks Board bring forward the restoration of the park, the planning that happened in 1996 and 1997, which is a culmination of 20-some years of community work. And as that was progressing forward, there was a plan called the 1997 Greening Plan. Now, because the P&E is staying, the city said that they need to look at the plan and redo a few things. But council made a decision in 2003 that they would not receive an application from the casino until there was a new plan for the park. That's a major component that never happened. So right now, the architect for the casino said he cannot design underground parking, he cannot look at where the stream is going to go and have to move the horse barns. All of those major components to the new plan have now been bypassed simply because we don't have a park plan and the casino has no way for their architect to design properly until there is a park plan. But that was something that council had thought of, and council had said in 2003 that they would not move forward until there was a park plan. The community was rushed through a whole visioning process. There was enormous amounts of energy put into trying to come up with a new plan. And right now the city employees are saying, we do have a new plan. It was adopted. But when you go back and you read the minutes in council, it wasn't adopted. Council actually instructed them to go back and further explore, and they specifically took out the word accept from the motion. So we're saying that has to be done. There has to be a plan first. The second, some more technical things, is there has to be a lease agreement. There has to be an operating agreement, and that is in negotiations, but it's not finalized. The public benefits have been talked about, but they're not finalized and legally signed. The development permit is now done, but it was supposed to be done before it was rezoned. And as a result of the order in which they did it, we cannot appeal to the Board of Variance, even though the casino has an entrance on Renfrew Street, which is a violation of our community vision city plan. So we have no recourse against some of those things because the zoning was complete before they finalized. Right now, this casino, whose stock is majorly falling in the stock market right now, they could decide it's too expensive, they could back out, and the land is already rezoned. And any other casino could come in and say, hey, we'd like to apply to put it in the Pacific Coliseum, or we'd like to apply to have slots in the community center. And they would have to go through a process, but they would not have to go through a rezoning or public hearings.
Let's look at some of the other conditions that you talked about, one being that there's an operating lease in place. What do we know about negotiations around an operating lease now?
They've started negotiating the operating lease about 9 months ago, and we have been asking for information about that and have continually been told it's a confidential lease, it's between the city and a company, we will not give out information. And so for 9 months, the city has refused to tell us or to show us a draft of what's being decided. They did come out with a little one-page information sheet, which raised a number of concerns. One of the things that they told us at that time was that the land value is based on what other racetracks are willing to pay in places like Cloverdale. And we just feel that Cloverdale farmland, compared to View property in downtown Vancouver, has a little bit different land value. And these are the kind of things that are being decided behind closed doors. And city employees have actually said that even council will not see the final document until it's signed by the city lawyer.
It's an interesting piece of logic, because I'm sure people who wanted to keep the racetrack in the city wouldn't kind of see being out in the valley as an equivalent when you're looking at it from those terms.
Well, that's right. Yeah.
What mitigation measures for local residents as a result of having slots in the park? Was there a harm reduction program that was supposed to be in place? Is it in place?
There is no harm reduction program, but it easily could be part of the operating agreement or part of the lease. And this was a major endeavor that we did. Is a number of residents put in enormous hours researching different things that could be done for harm reduction, and we asked council to ensure that that would be part of the operating agreement. Because it's a confidential agreement, we have no idea how much of that is being put in, and we know from casinos across Canada that usually it's not put in, that there's various things done by the provincial government. But you have to remember, the provincial government receives 65% of the income from the casino. Casino only gets 25%. The real culprit here is the provincial government itself is receiving the lion's share of the revenue of the losses. And so it's hard when it's the fox guarding the hen house. You know, the fox is guarding the hen house, and yet do they really want to guard it? Because if you put in too much harm reduction, then you don't make money. Because 40% of all income from slot machines comes from the addicts. You know, not that everybody's addicted, but 40% of the income is coming from those who are addicted. And that's a big figure, and that's another reason why these kind of agreements do need to be finalized and out to the public before the rezoning is approved. And all of that is backwards right now. They've decided, but that was in place. That was one of the things that they did say was going to happen, is that the rezoning would happen after these conditions were met.
What do you expect the impact will be on the immediate community surrounding Hastings Park if the slots become a reality?
Well, if the slots are successful and the projections that they say are right, much more is gambled, but $100 million a year comes out of the economy and doesn't come back in, because the lion's share is going to the provincial government, then the rest is going to a publicly traded company with about 2% in Vancouver. So you lose out of your economy a huge amount of money.
Is that out of the local economy in the surrounding neighborhood?
That's arguable. Most statistics say that 80% of the gamblers are local, and we know even right now from the racetrack that there's a lot of pedestrian traffic walking to the racetrack, and we would expect that to increase because casinos are proliferant. They're all over the place, and yes, there's people that go to Vegas, but whether you go to Richmond or whether you go to Coquitlam or whether you go to Burnaby or whether you go to this one, you generally go to something that's close to your home.
What other impacts are we going to see on the community there?
Well, we would expect to see the crime rates go up, because when people lose their bank accounts, and we would expect to see marriages fall apart, we would expect to see more troubles in family court, we'd see more social services involved in welfare situations. In the long run, it hurts our economy, it hurts our families, it hurts our community, and it causes all kinds of social problems that the government has to step in and help with, and that's an expensive endeavor in itself.
What remedy are you looking for if you receive a positive judgment from the BC Supreme Court?
We're looking for the BC Supreme Court to force the City of Vancouver to start back with their requirements and finalize all of their agreements and finalize all of the subject to conditions before they rezone. Now, if they go through that process, it does mean that some of these will have to be looked at by what is now a new city council. Could that change the situation? Possibly. Could a casino decide to back out? Yes, they might. But at least it will follow a democratic process where what has been said to the public is followed through with instead of sidestepped. And right now, it's just not proper for us to, you know, tell the community we're going to put all of these safeguards in place and then suddenly say we're going to bypass these and we'll rezone anyway. And that was probably in order to beat the civic election. They rezoned 2 weeks before the election last year.
As someone who lives in that neighborhood and was kind of involved in the process, in the sort of visioning process for the park, and what's your kind of reflection on how this whole kind of process has evolved? You know, as a citizen who has a stake in what happens at the park.
For those living in the community, it felt very much like it was being railroaded through. All of the polls were saying that the community does not want this, even the wider city does not want this, and yet it was run roughshod in. And so the other thing that's very disheartening for community workers is that they've spent 20 years, some of them are elderly people who started planning the park when they were quite young, and have just begun to see in 2000, 2001, and 2002 some of these things come into place with the Italian gardens, with the sanctuary, and there's a whole beautiful plan for a world-class park that is now being just stopped in the middle of it because of what happens in politics with changes that they want to bring in. And bringing in the slots was part of that. But our lawsuit isn't really against the casino. It's against the city for how they've mishandled the situation.
If how can people get involved if they want to support you in the court case or and also in developing the park for the community?
You know, it's a grassroots movement. Everybody is a volunteer. The Hastings Park Conservancy is all made up of volunteers, both local and farther away. We need more volunteers. We need, for the lawsuit, about $40,000, and we're not a rich community. We don't have a big sponsor behind this, and so there's definitely a need for finances in this case. People can simply go to hastingspark.ca, and if they log on to hastingspark.ca, they'll find contact information for us and phone numbers for us and that sort of thing. But yeah, right now the biggest need is finances for the case. That we have a top-notch lawyer who had actually been a city lawyer for the city of Vancouver, knows all the laws inside and out. He's very confident that our case is strong, but we need to actually pay the bill, which is going to be 40, 50 grand. So yeah, we're looking for some help with that. And then hopefully in the near future, we'll be back on track, and we're looking for volunteers to really think big picture. How is this stream connection going to go from Hastings Pond to New Brighton Salt Marsh and connect the whole way through so that pedestrians can go back and forth the whole way? How do you wind up redeveloping so that it doesn't feel like you're in an asphalt concrete park, but actually you have a place that you want to hang out with your kids and play in the playground and this sort of thing? So there's a lot to be done, and the park is well on the way. We're a far cry from where we were 20 years ago. It's a lot of good community work has been done, and a lot of it is already beautifully taken part. And we just want to see the rest of the plan be finalized and not see it derailed by what is currently looking like a 20-year agreement with a casino. And yeah, that's what we're hoping to see happen.
Well, thank you for joining me this morning and telling us about it, and good luck.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Take care. I've been speaking with David Bornman of the Hastings Park Conservancy, and their court challenge goes to court March 7th, and you can contact them at 604-254-6755, or you can go to their website, as David said, at hastingspark.ca.